Mouse Audio Podcast Network. Part of the Boundless Audio Podcast Network.
Everything's merry and bright when your wine is red or white. Welcome to Whining About History, the women's history podcast where two besties with breasties whine about women from history that you probably haven't heard of, but def should have. I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly.
And I pulled that intro out of my ass.
Yeah.
And within the last
sweet, though.
5 seconds. I described it as short and stupid, which I'm like, that's right where I live because that's me. But I like it short and sweet. I'm glad you put a positive spin on it. Kelly, can you replace my internal voice, my internal monologue?
I can work on it, yeah.
All right, cool. If I could just get like an earpiece.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like listening to my inner voice and you're like, God damn it, Emily, you stupid bitch. You're beautiful.
Exactly.
You're like yelling at me and then praising me.
Yeah, I could do that.
I love that. All right. Great. Kelly solved all my problems. Whoop, whoop.
That's what I'm here for, I guess.
I mean, you are the mind wizard. You're a mind witch. Psych witch. Oh, that actually sounds delicious. Like a psych
kind
witch.
Of, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a sandwich.
No, I'm kind
of psych witch. Oh, my. I'm so fucking hungry. Oh, my God. Today is the first day we have talked about it before, but the 24-hour taco place within walking distance is open finally.
Yeah.
And between episodes, we're going to be drunk taco bitches.
I'm excited.
I am salivating. I am so fucking hungry.
I don't understand why you don't eat dinner before you come over here.
I did, but I didn't eat like a full dinner because I'm like, tacos. Drunk taco bitches.
Yeah.
Bam, bam.
I'm so excited.
But before we get there, we're going to drink some wine to satiate our taco thirst. Our taco lust.
There you go.
Taco lust.
It's not going to satiate it. It's just going to like tide us over.
Whet our appetites for tacos and burritos and other South American and Southwestern flair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So today we are drinking the 2020 Brothers Miller. And like, this doesn't have anything to do with Stephen Millier or Miller, however the hell you say it.
Are you sure?
I don't think it does. I like to think, we've talked about this before, that our headcanon is that they're triplets and like two of them broke off and like made their own wine. And then the third brother is like, I'm going to go make my own wine or
something. So, yeah.
One of the pairs, one of the sets is the bitchy, whiny one. It might be all of them. Who knows?
Maybe they all are, exactly.
But this is at least two of the brothers who, you know, two of the triplets, headcanon, that broke off from Steven. And this is the Cabernet Sauvignon from California.
Ooh.
So, we are fifth generation California farmers, except for Steven, because he's a bitch. Since 1871, our family has been committed to sharing California's incredible wines with the world. Now, with your funding, two brothers can keep the legacy going. We hope you enjoy this robust Cabernet Sauvignon, made mighty flavorful by the California sun.
Mighty
flavorful. This hearty wine can help make your next meal a mouth-watering feast.
Oh.
With gratitude, Nicholas and Marshall Miller, or Millier.
One of the two.
So we got Nicholas, Marshall, and Stephen. In my headcanon.
In the headcanon.
This is, this is clocking in at a whopping 13.5 ABV.
Ooh.
Bring it on, boys. I haven't met an ABV I can't handle.
That she's aware of.
That I'm aware of. That I was conscious for.
There you go.
Where are we cheersing to? Impending tacos. It's like a threat and I love it. Threat with a threat of tacos. Ooh.
Subtle.
This is made hearty by the Californian sun. I dig it. Oh, sorry. It's made mighty flavorful, and it is a hearty wine. And I agree. It's mighty flavorful.
It is. Like, good for you. It's like subtle, but like also powerful.
See, I guess I don't totally get the subtlety. Maybe it's that first sip. I was like, oh, damn. Good job, California Sun. And to a lesser extent, the brothers Miller.
But only the two of them.
Only the two of them, not Steven. Steven's not a part of this. They made that very clear.
Yeah.
This is all about Nicholas and Marshall and their journey.
It's a wonderful journey.
It's good for you. Good for you. You know, just because you're family doesn't mean you have to work together or get along or like each other or love each other. You can hate your fucking family. They can suck. Hitler had family.
I don't know what I was expecting, but I was like,
I'm just saying, the very sudden name drop of Hitler just startled me. If Hitler's in your family, do you think everyone's like inviting him to Christmas?
No.
Fuck no. He's the worst.
People are finding out how to not invite him to Christmas and then not have him find out because they'd be like, you know how much he's going to bitch if he finds out we didn't invite him to Christmas.
Okay, y'all, you cannot tag the photos on social media because then Hitler's going to find out. Every family has a Hitler. Every family has the Hitler that they're like, we can't tag these photos or we can't post photos at this certain time because then that member of the family is going to find out that we had a gathering without them. And we gotta be very strategic.
Strategery.
God damn it. Okay, before we started recording, I told Kelly that there were no Nazis in either of my stories.
There is like a side mention of Nazis in mine, or like it's a side mention of World War II, which obviously means Nazis.
I guess
we didn't ask if mine had Nazis. I only asked if yours had Nazis.
You were like, mine has just, it's just like a whiff of Nazis. Yeah. It's just a whiff. You know, it's like an aftertaste of bile and hatred. I just finished Gerda Weissman's memoir.
Yeah.
And like, part of me is glad that I covered her before I listened to her memoir because I was like, oh my God, there's so much more. And I could not have like done this justice having like read the memoir and then done the episode. But it was so good. Like, it's obviously incredibly sad, but she goes into like how her and Kurt met like at the liberation and like their loves and just like you got so many more personal details that I just couldn't find online, and it was so good. Devastating, but so good. So yeah, I highly recommend All But My Life by Gerda Weissman Klein. Yep. All right, well,
I go first.
Oh, thank Christ.
Because you introed.
So I was like, first. Wait, do I have to go first? I feel like I have never stopped talking.
You will never stop talking.
If I hate talking so much, I really shouldn't be on a podcast.
No, like, I feel like you've maybe made poor life decisions up to this point.
I mean, that goes without question. There have been a lot of poor life decisions, and they keep me awake at night. You know that moment before you're like about to fall asleep and then it's like poor life decision number 783 pops in your head and you're like, oh, well, crap. Now I have to ruminate on this for 2 hours.
Yeah, you're like, well, shit.
Well, God damn it. I did that stupid thing in third grade. Fuck. Or last week. Shit. Or 5 minutes ago. Damn it. But Kelly, who are you whining about today? I'm trying to do the Moira voice.
I figured.
David, Kelly, who are you whining about? Fruit whining about today? I don't know what's fucking happening. It's been a week, and next week is gonna be a lot.
Pre-drowning her sorrows.
I'm pre-drowning my sorrows. Yeah.
See, mine's the opposite. Like, last weekend and this week has been a lot. I'm on day 3 of a migraine.
Oh.
Good times.
Should we turn the lights off?
No, it's fine.
Dude, but we like have this, our Christmas lights.
But like this week is going to be more of like a standard week. And then we have 2 weeks off of groups, which will be nice.
Good deal.
Good deal.
Good deal.
Good deal. All right.
Power through that migraine.
Altina Shanassi.
Altina Shanassi.
I might be pronouncing that last name incorrectly, but that's what I got when I like looked it up.
You know what, though? That's what we do on this show.
I like Altina. That's a pretty name.
It's a very pretty name.
Shanassi, not Shanassi. Just so everyone's clear.
We cannot. It needs to stop. God damn it.
So, here we go.
Really quick.
Yes.
Is she still alive?
No.
Okay.
Thank God.
I was editing the last episode, and as I was writing the episode description, I Googled.
You Googled her?
I Googled to make sure she was still, in fact, alive. Chu Yo-Yo is doing great.
Yeah, she's doing wonderful. Fine. I'm pretty sure she's on X fine. If you really want to follow her.
She's fucking fine.
No, this woman is not still alive.
God, okay, so no pressure. Nope, no pressure.
Not as much as, you know.
Yep. We're good here.
So, my brain just like stopped for a second. Altina was born on August 4th, 1907 in New York.
Hot.
She was born to a Jewish family. Her father was Morris Shanassi, who was in the international fine tobacco business.
The international fine tobacco?
Fine tobacco.
As opposed to the mid tobacco.
Exactly. And or the low tier tobacco.
The poor. And then just the meh tobacco.
The meh. Yeah. I don't know. That's what I said.
It's not great. It's fine. Everything's fine. Good for him.
Her mother was Lorette Shanassi, who was the granddaughter of Morris's like business partner in the fine tobacco industry.
Is there like a huge age gap between, okay, where's the age gap between him and his partner or him and his wife?
I think it's between him and his partner.
Okay, because I'm like, how does his partner have a grandchild who's age appropriate to marry?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there was an age gap between Morris and his wife as well, but I think the bigger age gap was between him and his business partner.
Okay, cool, cool.
Now I'm trying to look it up because I didn't like
if it's not important, but I'm like, it's not often that like you hook up with your business partner or your coworker's grandchild.
So he was born in 1855, and he met her in 1903, so he would have been 40 something years old.
Almost 50.
Yeah. She was 16.
Shit.
So yeah, I think there was an age gap both ways.
God damn it. You know what though? Doing this podcast long enough, there are certain things that we just
not
were like
shocked anymore.
Well, it's not even that, but it's like you hear something and you're like, oh shit, I know where this is going. Or yep, I bet there was a gross age gap. Or yep, this person was definitely part of the LGBTQ plus community because of this like weird sentence on their wiki that like alludes to it in a very non-committal way. Or just,
yeah. So for the first few years of her life, Altina was mentored at home. Obviously, like they were a very wealthy family being in a trade, especially like a trade like tobacco at the time.
Tobacco is all about the Benjamins.
Yeah, exactly. It always has been. It still is.
Yes.
Especially internationally. And so she was tutored at home to begin with, and then she would attend Horace Mann School. And then at the age of 12, she would be shipped off to boarding school at Dana Hall in Wellesley, Massachusetts. So it's like a very fancy... I know, I said Massachusetts, really
weird.
You
said weird. Massachusetts.
Like,
you know what's funny, though, when we were talking
I added CHs in there.
Well, it was funny, we were talking about mispronouncing things, and the first thing that came into my head was how Massachusetts sounds like a sneeze.
Yep.
And like, I mean, I live in the United States. I know how to say Massachusetts, but it's still like the most absurd
name. Well,
that's
a running joke in a lot of like TV shows of people like, or stuff where someone will say like Massachusetts and someone will be like, God bless you.
Bless you. Yep. Yep. No, I love listening to non-American podcasters mm-hmm. trying to say Massachusetts. Oh, there's a British podcast I listen to, and whenever they go to Massachusetts, they're like, this is the most absurd fucking thing I've ever. I'm like, no, you're right.
Yeah.
It's a mess. Yeah. Great state, terrible name.
Exactly.
You use Massachusetts as your password for a website, and they're like, that's entirely too long, and you used way too many weird characters.
Yeah, right? Like, what's with all these, like, double letters
this
and the S's?
This is too strong
of
a password.
Yeah. So the Dana Hall Boarding School was an independent boarding school for girls, grades 5th through 12th. And it operated as Wellesley College's preparatory program for, like, at least the beginning of its tenure. Like, not everyone that went to that school went to the college, but it was a really good, like segue into it. And there's actually, like, a lot of famous people that went through there that I don't recognize.
Well, we've covered women who went to Wellesley.
Yeah, a few of them. But, like, even I'm just looking at, like, on their wiki, the list of names, there's the Princess of Jordan that went there, a first daughter of Rwanda. So people, like, internationally were sending their children here. So it's not just, like, a famous boarding school for rich people from the United States. It's a rich people boarding school from all over.
It's a rich women's boarding school international.
Yeah. But yeah, so, like, a bunch of very famous people went there. And so she went.
Oh, Sylvia Plath went there.
Yeah.
Cool. Love her.
But yeah, so she went there, and while she was there, she was a member of this is a list of she was a member of a lot more things than I was ever a member of when I was in high school. So she was a member of the Athletic Association, the Christian Association, the varsity hockey team, and the college club. In addition, she served as chairman of the French club's decoration committee.
Committee. Wow. What a progressive and sex positive.
Just for the French
organization.
Just for the French students, though.
Well, France fucking hates me.
So yeah. French club's decoration committee. She was class historian.
Wait, their club, the French club, had their own decoration.
Apparently.
What the fuck is happening?
I don't know. She was class historian and the vice president during her junior and senior year for her class.
Jesus. And, like, this is at a prestigious boarding school where everyone is, like, the shit. Like, Pinky's way up, SpongeBob style, like...
I was drinking my wine, so I just stuck my pinky up so Emily could talk about it.
I was watching an anime with my friend. What's up, Jory? Friend of the podcast. And it's called Love is War, and it's about these two students. They're the president and the vice president at this very prestigious, like, ritzy high school.
Yeah.
And they're both in love with each other, but they're both entirely too proud to admit it. So then they're, like, constantly scheming, and it's kind of like a little vignette.
That's
like one episode will have different vignettes of, like, how they're trying to, like, manipulate each other. And it's super fucking funny. But that's what I'm imagining this school as.
Yeah.
Like, they're, like, she must be, like, the top of the top.
Yeah. So one interesting thing is that when she reflected upon her time at Dana Hall, like, when she was older, she explained that although she had many friends, she was in a lot of things, you know, she was very popular and good at, like, good at school. She often felt isolated because she was one of the only Jewish students on campus, and she would often hide that part of her identity from her classmates. Obviously, like, going as far as being part of the Christian Association and all of these things.
Oh my God, I didn't even put that together.
Yeah, like, so she is Jewish.
Yeah.
But because very few other students were Jewish, and, like, she didn't want to be left out, she just didn't talk about it.
Remember when we were a part of the Jewish student organization?
I know, I was like, we kind of had the opposite experience.
But for the same reason, there just weren't a lot of Jewish students on campus. At least Jewish students who wanted to participate in the, you know, the JSO. Yeah, so we were supporting our Jewish friend who was like, I need fucking members. And we're like...
Sure.
Culture. It was awesome.
Actually, I learned a lot.
I know. It was awesome. I wish I remembered more of what I learned.
Yeah, same. I learned a lot. Did not retain a lot of it.
You know what?
That's like most of my college experience.
This is appropriate because it is the second night of Hanukkah. Hanukkah just started last night at sundown.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah, y'all.
So upon her father Morris's death in 1928, his widow, Lorette, would travel to Manisa, Turkey. Sorry, Turkey. To establish the Morris Sanasi Kokukata Hasana. Nope. It's a children's hospital.
The children's hospital.
I was like, I'm going to try to pronounce this. And now that I've been drinking, I'm like, never mind.
Kelly, I really admire that you tried.
Hasta Hanesi. There we go.
Hasta Hanesi.
Yep.
Okay, cool.
Which is, or the Morris Sanasi Children's Hospital.
Cool.
And the reason she traveled to Manisa was because that's where her husband was born. Mm. So he was originally Turkish. And so.
Wow. I know it's not relevant to the story. I'd be curious to know more about the relationship that the husband dies and his, like...
Widow.
His very
extremely young widow.
Is entirely too fucking young for it to be okay. Widow is like, to honor him, I'm going to go back to his home country and open a school in his name. Like...
Hospital.
Like, that... Good for her. I love the direction that she's going. I'd be really... I don't know. I just kind of want to be nosy.
There's that part of my brain that's like, damn, how rich were they?
Oh, fucking rich.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it remains in operation today.
It's, oh my God.
A little subnote I put in there.
That's so cool.
Yeah, like the fact that like she was like, okay, I don't know what her husband's connection with like why she chose a children's hospital, but I just like that she
not bad for being a
1928.
Not bad for being a 16-year-old child bride.
Yeah.
Damn, girl. Damn, Lorette.
Right. So once Altina graduated from Dana Hall, Lorette took her and her sister to Paris. Because, I mean, what else do rich people do?
I mean, yeah. When I graduated from high school, my parents took me to the Titanic exhibit at the Science Museum. So, like, I get it. You graduate, you go on a little trip.
I got to go to London. I didn't go with my parents, but I went to London with my theater group.
I mean, I went up to the cities and saw the Titanic exhibit. You went to London. I would go to London later.
Yeah, you went to
I would
Ireland,
go later.
Like during
Scotland.
Or Scotland. Yeah.
Don't get them confused. They're going to be so pissed.
I don't know why. Like, I knew it was Scotland, but my brain was like, Ireland. Probably because I want to go to Ireland and I've been thinking about it lately.
I've also been thinking about it because now I now have a friend who lives in Ireland and I'm like, hey.
Me and you should go.
I also have been listening to Catherine Corliss's book, her memoir about like the mother and baby homes and her journey.
But me and you should go.
We should. You are dressed like Ireland today, basically. Yeah.
So while in Paris, Altina would meet up with her cousin Renee Bensoussan, who was an artist in Paris, and she would really just like fall in love with art and painting and all of that good stuff. She would begin spending more and more time with Bensoussan or Renee, and she would develop a much deeper appreciation for art. And as a result, when Altina would come back to the United States, she would choose to attend art school rather than a traditional college.
Isn't it nice when a young woman falls in love with someone and it actually just like benefits their life and benefits them culturally instead of being a traumatic experience that they
have to grow something. From?
Well,
Renee is her cousin.
Shit. I thought you said she fell in love with him.
No, she fell in love with art.
Okay. Okay, we're going to...
Backtrack.
Control, shift, S, strike through. We're going to ignore that. Isn't it nice when a young woman falls in love with something and they're, like, really passionate about it?
Well, and what's nice is, like, I couldn't find anywhere that her mom was like, no, you can't do that. You're a lady of standing. You know, like, because we've seen that in a lot of our other stories, particularly in the 1930s, which is about where we're coming up to. You know, it was very much like, no, you're rich. Like, do a rich person profession or be a homemaker. Like,
you get married.
Be a homemaker or become, like, a nurse.
Yeah.
But for a rich person, even then, they were kind of like, But, like, I just find it interesting that I couldn't find anything that was said that anyone in her family was opposed to it.
I love that. Also, Paris in the 1930s, what a wild time to be there. Like, because that's very much like the Lost Generation.
Just prior to the 1930s, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, that's still that generation. You know, there are all these artists, they're grappling with like post-World War One, upcoming World War II, because even though they didn't know it was coming, like that shit was building up.
There was stuff going on. Like, yeah. There was like the whisperings.
It was not a quiet time.
Yeah. So in addition to attending the Roerich Museum and studying with Samuel Halpert when she returned to the United States, she also would get married for the first time. She'd get married to a man named Morris B. Sanders. Yep.
Morris B. Sandin.
I don't know. I was just saying, yeah, because like that, yes, that is the same first name as her father.
Oh crap, I didn't put that together. I don't know if I could do that.
Yeah, that'd be weird.
I'd have to be pretty stuck.
Yeah. But I do know people like that like have like a brother-in-law and their husband and their dad and like all these people have the same first name and I'm like, all right, that's weird.
I don't know if I could just like say my dad's name in a fit of passion.
No,
though.
That's exactly what I'm thinking about. This is not the right wine. Can I have the correct wine instead of the wine that's been open for like 4 weeks?
My innards just dried up. I know, like
I was like thinking about it and I'm like, that makes me want to like vomit.
I would rather date someone with my own name and call out my own name during a fit of passion.
My friends tried to get me to do that once.
And I'm a little mad it didn't work out. I've never really forgiven you for that. I didn't know you at the time,
no. But
I feel like it was personally victimizing me.
That's funny.
Raise your hand if you've ever been personally victimized by Kelly.
Kelly?
Or just Kelly.
Just Kelly in general?
By Kelly not getting together with another Kelly. Like... I love it. I love it for the story.
Yeah. So she got married to Morris, who was an architect, and they got married in his home. And he was such a big deal in the architect world that like it was featured in Architect magazine. Yeah. And they would
go. The wedding or the home?
The wedding.
Oh my God. Well, I mean, I guess technically both then.
Right. They would go on to have two sons, Terry and Dennis. Both of whom would become film directors, and we'll never talk about them again.
Cool. Good for them. They have their own wiki pages. This is not about
probably,
them.
Probably. Good exactly. for them. So after some studying, Altina would take a job with a man named Peter Copeland designing windows for Fifth Avenue stores. So I don't know if they still do this. I've never been to Fifth Avenue. I've never been to New York. But like back then, they would have these like massive, absolutely gorgeous window displays. If you've never seen them, like Google Fifth Avenue window displays, because they were apps like literal, they would hire literal famous artists to come and design these things.
They would like have an unveiling. It was an event.
It was huge.
I know stores still definitely do it. I don't know
it's
if
like
it's
the bigger department stores.
Yeah.
Still.
Well, I think in big cities in particular. So I was in, last year, I was in Chicago in November, and there's the old Marshalls building,
oh, nice.
And they had, which
some
I think is a Macy's
displays.
Now, but yeah, they, I mean, animatronics, it's,
oh, wow.
It like told a story. Like
that's super cool, because like,
it's
I
something
mean,
we're not going to see where we live.
Right, like you see technical window displays. Technically, yeah. The mannequins in the windows at any department store is considered a window display, but when I'm saying window display in this case, like it is...
An artistic
top tier artistic design, like top to bottom, there was backgrounds and like multiple things going on. And like, yeah, it's good to see here that like some places still do it. And so I'm sure if Fifth Avenue still has those big stores, they probably still do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's more common in bigger cities with the like big old department stores. But when I was in Chicago, I saw it. I was like, oh my God, this is like,
that's
it
super
felt,
cool.
It was really cool. It felt a little anachronistic. Like it wasn't that the window display was dated, but just the idea of a window display was, I was like, oh my God, this is so classic.
Right. And I love that they're still doing it like for that reason.
Yeah. Because I like looking at shit.
Yeah. So speaking of like, the window people hiring very fancy artists. It was during this job designing windows that Altina found herself working with Salvador Dali.
Shut the front door.
Yep. So he had been commissioned to design two Bonwit Teller windows, which you can actually like Google. There's a whole story. There's a whole story because he did it like three times and they said the last one almost like broke his career. It was like I fell in a rabbit hole and then I was like, no, this isn't about him.
This isn't Salvador Dali's story.
So I reeled it back because it didn't involve her. but yeah, oh my God. So she's working alongside Salvador Dali. And I mean, other designers, but she was like the primary designer to build these windows that basically like he drew up and was like, here, this is my vision. Make it a reality, basically.
She was the builder.
Yeah. So she worked like one on one with Salvador Dali to build these windows for the Bonwit Teller.
Also, Salvador Dali he's considered like the father of surrealism, yada, yada, big fucking deal. He designed department store windows. There's no such thing as selling out. Like, I just want to say, we all need to eat. We all need to make money. Like, don't get too caught up in the whole, like, artistic suffering trope to just express yourself in whatever avenue that you can.
Yeah. And I will say, like, if you, like, kind of Google some of the ones that he did, like, they're a little weird.
Well, that dude was super weird.
But yeah, because like one of them was like this woman and then there was like a, like tree branches that were like, it was weird. And I was trying to figure out like which one Altina did and it was very hard because a lot of them are about like the last one he did, which is the one that almost like ruined his career.
Oh my God. Well, did it ruin his career? Cause it like broke him emotionally or because they hated it so like, much.
It was just it was weird because yeah, it was we're not getting into it.
It's fine. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have asked.
We'll talk about it later.
Yeah.
But he like demolished it. The second one, like, I don't know what it was, but he got like super, I never finished reading it because I was like, but yeah,
he threw an artistic tantrum.
Yeah, he threw a tantrum and like destroyed it. But yeah.
They are really weird.
Yeah. But she was the one that helped like realize his vision, so I think mm-hmm. is super cool.
No, to be like a burgeoning artist and to be working with Salvador Dali, that's insane.
Right? Like, I mean, yeah, even just to have an appreciation of art and mm-hmm. work with Salvador Dali. Like, because even if he was early in his career, like you're going to know who he is.
100%.
Which is super cool.
That's your fun fact for every like introduction game where it's like, tell us your name and something fun about you. It's like, I designed store windows with Salvador Dali. Like you never have to be anything. You're never going to be more interesting. Although right. I have a feeling she does become more interesting.
She does. So, in 1932, Altina connected with a man named George Grosz, who was a German artist who had fled Hitler's regime. See, this is my Nazi adjacent thing. Okay. My whiff of Nazis.
Yeah. That bile-y, vomity taste in the back of your throat.
So I looked him up. He's not Jewish or anything, but it's just that he was artistic and Hitler didn't like artists.
Oh no, he fucking hated them.
Yeah.
Because
along
they
with
gonna,
like most other people.
This is true, but yeah, it's like the journalists and the artists and the writers mm-hmm. is like what a lot of these dictatorial people go after. That's who
first.
They go after first because they're like, you're going to expose
right.
what I'm doing. And
it's
not
either you fall in line and you tell the story I want you to tell.
Yeah.
Or you're not going to be around.
Yeah. Also, World War II Germany was not a great place to be.
No.
Regardless.
Right. So he moved to New York after fleeing Hitler, and Altina got to connect with him, who was an artist that she had long admired, which is, I think, so cool, like, being able to, like, meet someone through horrible circumstances, but still, like, so he would teach intermittently at the Art Students League, and during this time, Altina was a divorced mother of two. She had gotten divorced from her first partner, and she would study under him when he set up, a school of his own with a painter named Maurice Stern. So it was, interestingly enough, Altina again met Salvador Dali in his classes.
Oh my God.
Wait,
Salvador Dali was taking classes from this guy?
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, and yeah, like, so they would like get to know each other even more and like be able to kind of like share a bunch of stuff, which I think is so, so cool.
You know she's at parties and she's just name dropping like crazy. Oh, yeah, like, oh yeah, I'm just hanging out with Salvador Dali and this, you know. And, I'm sorry, the other gentleman's name, George Groves.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not a household name to me, but like, you know, she's just like, oh yeah, we were just like hanging out, we like got coffee. And,
right. You know that guy with art. The melting clocks? Yeah. Yeah, I know him.
Yeah, like, it's no big deal.
We're BFFs.
We just like designed some windows together and like, it was all right. It was fine. Like, she's downplaying it even though everyone
chill.
Else.
Chill. Don't yeah. worry about it.
Yeah, no, it was cool. It was
you
cool.
know, I helped.
I bummed a cigarette right. off and it was great.
Exactly. Oh, that's funny. So even while she was taking classes, Altina also liked to invent things. A lot of them were like new fashion things. And so she would be quite frequently registering for patents.
Love it.
Throughout her entire life. So like, I don't mention it a lot after this because none of them really amounted to anything. And so I couldn't find a lot of information on like what they were, but there's enough information on like that she was registering for different patents throughout her life. So her big breakthrough in registering for patents and things that actually went somewhere happened when she was designing the window for Dali. She was like walking around Fifth Avenue and she was walking around and she like saw an eyeglass place and was like looking at them. And she was like, man, all of these frames are super fucking boring.
We all know what the frames looked like at that time, just right. from World War II footage.
Yeah, they're just very basic.
Harry Potter glasses.
Yeah. And so she was like, this is so boring. Like, everything's so lackluster and everything's just like, she's like, everything's kind of gross. Like, especially for women.
Ew,
like, everything's so basic.
Yeah, basic.
And so she was like, you know what? I can do better. She's like, I want to create something that's whimsical and mysterious and romantic and like, you know, kind of conveys that.
I want to create a pair of glasses that fucks.
Yeah. Did you already read my notes or do you know where I'm going with this? Do you know what style of eyeglasses?
No, I'm just saying like just from what you were talking about. Well, it's not like the little oval ones. Is it like the big bug eye glasses that were like really popular for sunglasses?
No.
Okay.
Do you know what cat eye glasses are? The ones that have like the wingtip?
Oh, God. Yep. Fucking. Okay. Those glasses yeah. fuck. Those glasses
exactly.
fuck every day of their lives.
So originally that's not what they were called. They were called Harlequin eyeglass frames, which I'm like, why would you not continue calling them that?
Is because Harlequin a not okay word anymore?
I don't think so. I think it's fine.
I mean, Harley Quinn is still named after it and she hasn't been
I just
canceled.
Think of like Harlequin romance.
Yeah. Or just kind of like that, like, you know, the Harlequin pattern, the Harlequin like jester thing, like, well, they're fun and crazy.
She designed them after Harlequin masks.
Oh my God.
Because you think they're pointed. Like, if you think of just the traditional mask that goes over and then they're pointed at the corners.
I
just
never
like the glasses
fucking
are.
Put that together before.
Neither did I until I read about Altina and then I was like, you're a genius.
I don't know anything that's going on around me.
But yeah, it's incredible. She settled, like, so she started with the mask because she was like, oh, this, like, shape is really pretty and, like, the mystery and the romance and everything like that. And so she began there and, like, began to cut masks into frames until she, like, narrowed it down to what would become the Harlequin eyeglass. And then from there, the cat eyes, I think what it's modernly called.
Yeah.
So she would patent her designs in the 1920s and approach all major manufacturers with her creation and her patents, all of which rejected her, claiming it was too edgy.
Okay.
For the 1930s?
Yeah.
It probably is.
It was too edgy, but it was just the kind of edge they needed.
Right. So by the late 1930s, Altina had found someone to produce the glasses, and her production of the frames and a partnership with some department stores saw these glasses become incredibly popular, incredibly fast in the Americas, at least.
I'm just going to say, we will buy fucking anything.
Well, and if you think about the fashion of the 1930s, everything was kind of drab and boring. It's wartime, or it's coming into wartime. supplies are limited. So I'm especially for women to be like, oh my God, like look at this thing that doesn't probably cost any more than a regular pair of glasses.
Right.
But has this like flair and mystery and, you know, like it's different.
But do you remember those, I think they're called like popcorn shirts from the early 2000s where it's like you hold it up and it looks like it's fit for a baby, but yeah. It expands.
I had like one of those.
Those were everywhere.
They were. And like, yeah, it was, they
we
were the
will
weirdest
buy
shirts.
Fucking anything in the United States, North America, however you want to quantify it. Like, but these are actually really cool glasses.
I mean, I think it's funny though, because I like think about it and I'm like, God, we will buy anything. But then I also think about like New York fashion shows or Paris fashion shows. And I'm like, have you seen what they're wearing?
Okay. But you know what I want to do? I want to watch one of those from like 50 years ago and be like, oh yeah, no, we're wearing that exact thing. It's just like, so
it's so far ahead. In advance.
It's so far. Or like they're parts of it that we take today.
So once she had everything like set up and like deals negotiated with department stores, she would open up an office where she would oversee marketing and distribution, later expanding her operation. So she started in New York and then would later expand to the West Coast as well after she would relocate to California. So she would have someone else run the New York office. She would relocate to California and open an office there. She, because of these glasses, which I think this is well-deserved, in 1939, she would win the Lord and Taylor Annual American Design Award for her avant-garde transformation of eyeglasses into a proper fashion accessory.
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Because, like, so the 1920s were definitely a time of, you know, like, opulence and, like, fucking go for it.
Oh,
we're
yeah.
not a world at war anymore. But, like, the 1930s with the Great Depression, all this other, you know, it's the idea of turning a necessity into a fashionable accessory.
Mm-hmm.
Because like, if you need glasses, you fucking need glasses.
Right.
Okay.
As the glasses wearing person in this partnership, yes. I understand.
Well, and during.
And yeah, like I don't like the basic frame. So like, had I been alive back then, I would have 1000% been like, I am buying those.
Totally. But like, you know, we think about clothing and fashion as a way to express yourself, but you can, especially during the Great Depression, they turned seed sacks into dresses.
Yeah.
But glasses, I mean, that was kind of something you can make your own glasses, but to have that option to get something a little more out there, a little more fashionable, just a little more fun, and to turn a necessity into a statement. So fucking cool.
Right? Yeah, even Vogue and Life magazines credited Altina with revolutionizing the eyewear industry and like the aesthetics of it.
Well, because I'm sure it wasn't really a fashion-forward thing. Nowadays, you can't pass an eyeglasses store without it being like the newest lenses and like models wearing glasses. Like it is marketed
right.
as fashion.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, that's so cool.
I know. So roughly 20 years after patenting this iconic frame, she would sell her eyeglass business and move to Los Angeles. She would expand and then sell her eyeglass business. Because like I said, she moved to the West Coast, made a base there, and then she would sell it in hope of pursuing art full time.
Aw, and she's like, I have my nest egg. She
right?
she went Tom
exactly.
from,
she was like, I have the money.
She went Tom from MySpace where she's like, I made this awesome thing. I made a bunch of money off of it, and I sold it for even more money, and now I just get to do whatever the fuck I want,
right.
and I don't have to testify before Congress.
Right. So during this time, she would marry her second husband, a Viennese doctor and a classical pianist, because, of course.
A classical pianist.
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 His name was Eric Barrett, which is cool. She began studying with Howard Warshaw at the Jepson School of Art, and she would say, quote, I took a room in the house as my studio and put a sign on the door. Do not come in unless there's a catastrophe. I wanted to have 3 hours a day just to myself without interruption, and I really did work very hard.
That is the fucking dream.
Right.
3 hours out of my day, not counting sleeping at night without... Actually, I don't even think I get 3 hours at a time without interruption.
No,
at
not
night.
With the dogs I have.
No, it's... Oh my God.
Yeah.
There's so many people who would kill to just have 3 hours, guaranteed 3 hours
a
day to do whatever the fuck they wanted.
It says do not come in unless there's a catastrophe.
Oh, I love that.
But yeah, she did. She really began to like paint in earnest, and a lot of like big paintings, to the point where a lot of her big paintings were selected to be exhibited at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. So yeah. She would also volunteer as an art therapist and a muralist at experimental mental health centers, particularly Cyanon, which I had never heard of prior to researching this.
Wait, like Cyan? Like Mount Sinai?
It's Cyanon.
Oh yeah, I don't know. Probably Cyanon, you're right.
So I looked it up because I was like, the fuck is this? So it's really interesting because I like looked it up, and apparently it used to be called Tender Loving Care, and it was a religious movement. It was a cult.
Mm.
It was a
California loves their cults.
One of the top things when you Google Cyanon or however you pronounce it, literally the title of the article is "The story of this drug rehab turned violent cult is wild country caliber bizarre."
You know what? Actually, I may have heard of this, like in a true crime podcast.
Probably.
Because there were stories of people who actually like went there to get help with their substance abuse and their addiction issues. And it was great. But then it got real, real fucked up.
Yeah, there was a lot of like weird things going on there. I didn't fall down that rabbit hole because I love true crime. And I was like, if I fall down this rabbit hole of looking into this cult, I will not finish Altina's story.
Welcome to the Church of Cyanon podcast.
Exactly. So I was like, I'm bookmarking this for a later date. Yeah. And I haven't got back to it yet, but I plan to.
So she did a mural for them.
Well, yeah, she was like an art therapist. Probably she didn't, it doesn't sound like she ever joined the cult or anything like that.
Here's the thing, though. The most successful cults start out feeling incredibly legitimate. Like, Scientology, and they're going to fucking come for me.
You need to drink more wine.
When they talk about, I'm drinking it. When they talk about like ways to be less stressed, they talk about the same things that literally anyone will tell you, like breathing exercises.
They look at the research,
and then it turns weird
once you're there.
But yeah, it just kind of slowly gets you into your. Oh, this has been working so far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
How are your thetans doing, Kelly?
My thetans?
Or your theon, whatever they call them. Thetans, in Scientology, they give you a test and you hold the metal things and they tell you like how many thetans you have.
Oh.
And that number.
I forgot about that. Like, tells like, you what rank you are. Or
it's
whatever.
Like how pure or whatever the fuck it is you are or not. And it's like, oh, you have to do all these things to get more or less because you're possessed by alien ghosts that died in a volcano.
Sorry, hold on.
It's fine. Scientology.
Scientology. Died in a volcano.
It's Scientology.
I'm sorry. Like it took. Yeah, exactly. No, they're not. But it took my brain a second to catch up with what you were saying. And then I was like, wait, aliens that died in a volcano.
And now their ghosts possess us. Okay. That's totally how it works. And then you have to give them a bunch of money.
Okay, so I'm going to nerd out for like 2 seconds, probably like 10 seconds.
Go for it.
But like, so Final Fantasy 14, spoilers if you like haven't played the game and you really don't want to know. But part of the concept is that like you're a split soul. So you're part of another soul that's split across like a bunch of different shards. And that for some reason, that's what it makes me think of. Like you're not your soul. You're part of a bigger soul.
That also is very Kingdom Hearts. And that shit is so convoluted.
Oh God, you have no idea. Thanks for a good story though.
Oh, I know. I wish I could have kept, like the first game was my favorite thing in the world. But by the time the second game came out, which was like, 8 years later, like a ridiculous amount of time, it was $50. I was in high school. I didn't have the money to afford it. And I was waiting for the price to go down. Then I was in college and it never happened. It just never happened for me. I don't have room in my life for it. I don't think I have the mental energy.
I always wanted to play it because like I remember like seeing, because it was a PlayStation game. I didn't own a PlayStation.
PS2.
And I always remember wanting to play it because I saw like the ads, and then I remember watching someone play it and being like, I'm okay that I didn't play that.
And the music and the ads, like, Utada Hikaru.
Beautiful.
Oh my God. Like, I wasn't really super into video games as a kid. And then I heard the music in those ads and I'm like, I need this. And I asked for it for Christmas and I got the game and the PS2. And I was like, oh my fucking God. But then we didn't know that you needed a memory card for the PS2 that's sold separately because God fucking damn it. So I played the first, like,
I'm glad
several
they
levels.
Stopped that.
Right? But I played the first several levels of that game over and over and over and over and over because every time I turned it off, I lost all my progress.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's funny. It's like time. Horrible, but now it's funny.
Oh, I remember back in the day where you had to walk uphill both ways in the snow to get to school. I remember in the day where you need to buy a separate memory card. Right.
I
had to go down to the Walmart.
I distinctly remember, yeah, like memory cards and stuff like that. I remember buying a separate memory card for my GameCube because it didn't have a lot of internal storage and I had too many games. So I had to buy like, and it had two ports for memory card. Yeah. Okay.
Oh my fucking God.
If you want, there you go. I could do a whining about by myself on video games if you want me to.
God damn it.
Emily would just sit there and shake her head at me. Anyway, so as she's working on her art, something she started putting her entire effort toward was something that ended up being called George Graz's interregnum, which is a
wait, the egg went into her what?
interregnum. Into her egnum. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, the egnum. I'm very familiar with it. I think it's near the pancreas. Yeah,
exactly. So you remember George Graz was like her teacher, and he's the guy that escaped Hitler. Yeah. So basically, this was a short documentary film that she conceptualized and produced with his permission that features like him and his anti-Nazi work and like celebrated his life and like his art and all of this stuff and like his like fleeing from Hitler and all this stuff that he did.
Well, he sounds like a really interesting historical figure.
Yeah.
That's awesome that she got to do that.
What I love about it is his permission was given and a contract was written on a napkin. I'm like, that's fantastic.
This is like the stories of J.K. Rowling, like writing Harry Potter on napkins at a coffee shop. Like this is, that's, oh
but
my
yeah,
God.
But yeah, so she got his permission, like I said, and she would create a film of his drawings shot on 16 millimeter film. His book called A Big No and a Little Yes was the source of any of the narrated text that was provided by the film that was read by a person named Lot Lenya. It would go on to be nominated for an Academy Award and win first prize at the Venice Film Festival, even
her
though I've never heard
movie?
Of it. Yeah, this short film that she made about George's life.
Honestly, I'm just going to say it right now. The stuff that really wins prestigious awards, we've never seen and we've never heard of.
Right. So if you ever look it up, Altina is credited as the producer. However, you'll notice it is under the name Altina Carey instead of Altina Shinesi because at this time, her husband had died, her second husband, died from tuberculosis.
Ooh.
And she had gotten married for the third time to a man named Charles Carey. So therefore, she's credited as Altina Carey at the time.
It's like on her IMDb where it's, you know, it says all the stuff that she worked on that says credited as.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And so this film is preserved by the Academy Film Archive. It wasn't preserved until 2013, but there is a preservation of it out there that will live on for probably forever, depending on how it's preserved.
That's incredible. And I know for the film archive, like a film has to be around for so long because they're like, well, we don't want to preserve this because it was popular at the time.
Yeah. And so
we don't want to preserve 50 Shades of Grey because a bunch of thirsty women dragged their boyfriends to it.
It was, I think it's about 40 to 50 years. And I say that because she made the film in 1960. And so, and it was preserved in 2013. So I'm guessing it's 50 years and they were about 3 years late.
Okay. It might be less than that because I remember Aqua Teen Hunger Force, that movie kind of.
Oh, God,
like,
really?
Aqua Teen, I don't think it was preserved, but when that deadline came around, the Aqua Teen Hunger Force movie was like campaign. They're like, write your congressman to have this film preserved because it's eligible technically.
That's so weird.
That'd be so fucking hilarious.
Okay, now I have to look it up just because I'm super curious.
Well, you keep telling your story. I will look it up.
Okay, I will. So after she worked on her short film, and obviously, like, working on the short film brought up a lot of feelings for her being a Jewish woman and, like, having, you know, learning more about, I mean, she lived through it, but in the Americas, which is, you know, like, there was a little bit of cushion between what happened and being there. But, you know, she read all about these, like, social injustices and all this stuff that happened during World War II. And so afterwards, she's like, you know what, I'm really drawn to Martin Luther King Jr. and, like, all, like, this cause that he has. And, like, of course he's in the right and all this stuff. And she was like, you know what, it's time to speak out. Like, and I'm sure also being, like, a Jewish person and being, like, we're kind of also an underdog. Like, not to that extent, but, like, historically.
I mean,
in certain parts of the world, yes, they are that underdog. But, like, in America, they haven't necessarily been as targeted as a lot of other minorities.
I understand what you're saying, especially in the United States when we talk about slavery and systemic racism. But I think that, I don't know if it's a Martin Luther King Jr. quote, but it's like, threat to justice somewhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
Exactly.
And it's like, okay, we've just come out of this horrific war where Jewish people were targeted severely, right.
Jewish,
you know,
people, disabled people, like all of these, like, people. And
actually, it makes me more infuriated that in the United States we could go over and be like, we're fighting the Nazis, and then come back and be like,
but you can't have
different
rights
for Black people, though.
Yeah. And so she found herself really drawn to Martin Luther King, and particularly his march on Washington.
Big fucking deal.
To which she acquired the film rights for.
Yes!
So Altina engaged author John Oliver Killens, who I have absolutely no idea.
Not the John Oliver that we're thinking of from Daily
but
Show.
But she commissioned him to write a screenplay on this march. So I think it was after the march happened, and she was like, I want to make a movie about this. So Killens wrote a script, and Altina met with Martin Luther King Jr., like, with the script in Atlanta, and was like, can you, know, like, she's like, I want to make sure this is right. And so when she met with him, he was like, come with me to the Savior Church in Montgomery, Alabama. That's where his father was pastor.
Yeah.
So Martin Luther King Sr.
And Montgomery was a significant place in the civil rights movement.
Yep. So his father was the main pastor, and Martin Luther King Jr. was the guest preacher that Sunday that he invited her to go. So she went, and from the pulpit, Martin Luther King Jr. gave this speech and told this entire congregation about the script and how he looked forward to this movie and how moving it was and how true to reality it was.
Don't finish this, because I feel like you're going to fuck my shit up.
I am.
You're going
to.
But
there's a little bit more, and then I fucked shit up.
Okay.
So while in Alabama, she also got to meet Rosa Parks.
Oh, my God. Yep. Is she being Forrest Gump and just meeting, like, every historical person and being part of, like, every historical
And she would also tape an interview with Reverend Ralph Abernathy. And I'm like, that name sounds familiar, but I can't place it.
I'll look it up.
Okay, good.
But while I'm looking stuff up, really quick. So the National Film Registry will add up to 25, quote, culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant films each year, showcasing the range and diversity of American film heritage, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. A film becomes eligible for inclusion 10 years after its
original. 10 years, that's it?
10 years. I mean, I guess, how many movies came out over 10 years ago that we don't fucking like?
Yeah.
If it's still popular in 10 years, especially now with our short attention spans,
yeah,
it might be worth taking another look at.
Right. So Ralph Abernathy was a close friend and mentor to Martin Luther King Jr.
Aww.
I looked it up. So, yeah. So after she, like, talked to all these people, got the script approved, a man named Vittorio De Sica, who's an Italian film director, expressed interest in directing the film. However, she never found funding for it. And even though she found some politically sympathetic investors, the film was never made.
What?
Part of me hopes and wonders if somewhere out there in the archives or even in her personal documents, like, does this script still exist? Could we still make
this
film?
Can we see the screenplay? Because it would be archival footage, but we've got archival. I'm not going to say we have a lot. We have archival footage. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I know. Oh, yeah.
God damn it. Yeah. Oh, my God. This is why we fund the arts.
But I'm going to talk about a pun that Altina didn't really create but used, and you're going to love it.
Was she a punisher? Was she a fellow punisher?
Kind of.
I love it.
So
I'm wet with anticipation.
After all this film stuff, an artist named Henry Carter Bresson took a bunch of photographs of, like, unoccupied chairs. I didn't look into what the whole purpose of it was, but I think it was kind of like a missing, not necessarily missing people, but like kind of like a,
the absence,
exactly,
the emptiness.
So Altina once saw this art, and she was inspired to combine the function of the seat with the form of the sitter. So have you seen those things where it's like a person, but it's also a chair? She started that.
Wait, you mean like kink play?
No.
Like, where, like, people like a, pretend like to be sculpture. Furniture.
Oh. Like a sculpture where it's a person, but it's also a bench.
So it's the person in a sitting position with the absence of what they're sitting on, but then they function as the seat.
Yes.
Okay. I thought you were talking about, like, that. There's that kink play where people pretend to be furniture.
Yeah, no.
Okay, nope. No. I'm like, wow.
No.
There's a lot of people that can thank her.
Are you ready for the pun, though?
Yes.
She called these chairs and benches characters. It's characters mixed with chair. Characters. I guess it's not really a pun, but it's...
No, it is! It's so beautiful!
Yep.
It's so perfect! It's so specific, too!
Yeah.
Oh my God, you know she fucking thought of the pun and was like, I need to make this art.
Right.
The pun always comes first. Oh my God. Oh, yeah. Hold
and
on.
They're actually really cool if you, like, look them up.
Hold on, I need a second.
I know you do.
I'm so spent.
She's just like, ugh.
She's
in the post-coital glow, guys.
Yeah, I there's no blood going to my brain right now. Oh my God. I'm all tingly. That's amazing. Characters.
So she would first start, like, she made the core out of styrofoam and then would sculpt plaster around that and then do a fiberglass cast. And so the final products were made of the sculpted prototype at a studio and factory in California. They were popular enough to be featured on the cover of Los Angeles Times magazine.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And they're actually really cool. So, like, one of the ones, if you, like, just Google the word caricatures, CHAIRACTERS, the, like, second photo is, one she did that's supposed to, I think, be like Cleopatra and Mark Antony.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
But it's also like a bench.
I also love, like, they kind of look old Roman.
Yeah, and then, like, there's, like, another one that's like
antique.
I don't know what it is, but it looks like a farmer sitting on a thing. Yeah, anyways, it's very interesting.
It's a boy, his mother, and a horse. These are so fucking fun. I love it.
Right. And I mean, some of them are like a shampoo company, but, like, if you search that plus Altina, like, you'll get what you're looking for. Because, yeah, some of them are, like, kind of weird.
I love it.
But yeah, like, you think about it and I'm like, oh yeah, I've seen other things like that are like the similar, where it's like a statue, but it's also a bench.
100%. Functional art is really popular.
Yeah. So yeah, after that, she would move to Washington, D.C., where she would live for the next 17 years. She would be interviewed by Pam Peabody for WPFW Washington about her exhibit at the Touchstone Gallery, as well as her life, work, and experience, particularly at Sinanon, Because I'm pretty sure in 1973 is when stuff started getting weird over there. And like I said, she wasn't like super in, like she wasn't part of the cult, but she was there.
Okay, here's the thing though. You attend a single recruiter meeting for one of those cults. Like, oh my God, what's the one where the leaders got busted? It's got like a bunch of weird letters in it. Shit. Oh, I don't remember. But anyway, like they would have recruiter meetings where it's like they would get really super attractive members of the cult to like try and lure you in. They would go to college campuses.
Oh yeah. I mean, you think about even Manson, like he would a lot of times send the female members of yeah. his family out.
Yeah. But it's like you go to one of those meetings, people are going to never stop asking you yeah. about it. And honestly, I would never stop talking about it.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
Yep. So sometime in all of the caricatures, signing on experience, she would, I couldn't really find what happened, if he died or they separated or whatever, but she would no longer be with her third husband.
Okay.
This becomes important in a little bit. But so she, while she was working on her caricatures, I put this word in there so many times just for you.
I love that every time this word came up, you thought of me.
I did.
I want to live rent-free in your brain in that specific right. way.
So this is after the interview. So she's still working on them. And during this time, her studio assistant left. So she hired a man named Celestino Miranda, who was a refugee seeking asylum from Cuba at the time.
Oh my God.
The '70s.
Yep.
Yep. There's shit going down in Cuba.
The '70s were wild.
Yeah.
Is there a decade that wasn't super fucking wild? Could we get one of those, please?
Yeah, right. During this time when Celestino was her assistant, Altina would travel to Santa Fe for the summer and Celestino would accompany her. He was a gifted artist in his own right and would prove a great collaborator and inspiration for her. And when they would return to Washington at the end of the summer, they would be a couple and would end up marrying in 1981. So husband number four. She just really liked companionship, and I do not blame her for it.
I mean, to her credit, at least one of her husbands died.
Yeah.
So I was reading, it was one of those awful listicles of like weird things doctors have experienced. And there was a ophthalmologist who was giving someone an eye exam, and it was a male ophthalmologist. It was a female patient. And the patient is like, oh, you look like you look like my third husband. And the ophthalmologist is like, oh, how many husbands have you had? And she's like, two.
Yep.
And I'm like, I don't know if that actually happened or if that's just one of those like terrible jokes.
That's hilarious.
But that's though. What this feels like.
Yeah. That's super funny. So as she would get older, because she's getting older at this point, Altina would continue to paint and sculpt and would establish herself as a home or her home base in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where she would live with Celestino until her final years. There is a very well-produced documentary about her life entitled Simply Altina that was actually made by her granddaughter.
That is so cool! Right? Oh my God.
I love when stuff is made by a family or like contributed on even by yeah. a family member. Like I feel like it just makes it that much more powerful and honest. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, that's super cool. Well, and you said her, what was it? Her brothers became filmmakers?
Her two sons,
excuse me. So it runs in the family for sure.
Yeah. So Altina would pass away at the age of 92 on August 19th, 1999 in Santa Fe at her home. I tried looking up like what happened to her just because I'm always curious, but I think it was just old age.
She was 92. Yeah. At that point, it's like, we don't need a reason. Actually, not having a reason is probably better because if there was a reason, it'd be like, she was murdered or hit by a bus.
Yeah, exactly. So, what I think is really cool And one of the things I kept in here that was on Wikipedia, but I was just like, okay, this actually needs to stay in there because this is a really cool little factoid. Mm-hmm. So apparently, like, there is such a strong association with Harlequin or cat eyeglasses and females. It's just how it is. Like, you're never going to see, okay, not never. You're very rarely going to see a man wearing Harlequin eyeglasses.
We all know those glasses, and we all know them from, like, 50s, 60s, like, even 40s movies. Like, the secretary is like, the department of blah, 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 hold,
actually,
please.
If you think about Monsters, Inc., the, like, slug-like,
oh my god,
old lady,
Roz,
wears
she fucking wears them glasses. Because it's very much like the, like,
it is
the office of Mr. James whatever, hold please, want,
and,
you know.
And the reason I bring up the super strong association is because there's a cartoonist, Gary Larson, the guy who draws The Far Side, and he uses,
shut the fuck up,
he routinely uses cat eye or Harlequin glasses to identify human and animal characters as adult females rather than males or juveniles.
You're right.
Like, and he has actually, like, I think come out and, like, said that, I think, don't quote me, allegedly.
Big asterisks, don't sue us, we have nothing. Oh my God, that is so cool. But I mean, really, when we think of those kinds of glasses, we definitely think of women.
Oh yeah.
100%. That doesn't mean only women can wear them, but the pattern has traditionally been.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I want a pair now. So I went shopping with your sister-in-law years ago, and she bought a pair of sunglasses that were like, kind of like that, but they were a combination of like the bug eye sunglasses and the cat eye.
Oh, interesting.
Because they were really big and long, but they had the like...
Yeah, the like point of the Harlequin cat eye sunglasses.
Yes, and they were so fabulous. And I'm like, I just want those sunglasses now. That's incredible. And think about all the weird sunglasses that came out in the 80s, like the ones that look like lightning bolts or like they went in two different directions, like... This pioneered that.
Yep.
And just the idea of glasses being more of a fashion statement than simply a practical tool.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
Right. So on August 4th, 2023, apparently Google did a Google Doodle to celebrate her 116th birthday.
Oh my God, that was just this last year.
Yeah, I know.
What was I doing in August?
Apparently it said, happy birthday to the woman who was a visionary in more ways than one. And her son, Terry Sanders, helped like design it.
Mm-hmm.
And also shared a note on behalf of his family that read, happy birthday, Tina. Thank you for your courage, kindness, and inspiration. Much love always. But yeah, if you think about it, Altina really was someone who represented change. Like, she worked toward producing a documentary for Martin Luther King Jr. She worked really closely with someone that was a refugee from first Germany and then, you know, a different man that was a refugee from Cuba. Like, she wasn't discriminatory, and probably because she, like, lived her life, particularly her younger life, knowing what it felt like to be
othered. Yeah.
And hiding it.
Yes.
And so, yeah, like, she was a woman that, like, clearly lived life to the fullest and just kind of did what she wanted, but did what she wanted in a way that was helpful to other people.
She was a pioneer, and she was a visionary in such a cool and artistic way. I feel like we might know her more had that movie been made, because obviously...
I'm still mad that it didn't get made. Like,
Martin Luther King Jr.
when I read that part.
But Martin Luther King Jr. is such a notable figure, especially in American history, and the people who are associated with him are getting a lot more attention. Oh my God, I'm blanking on his name. Ruxton. There was like one of his close friends who also worked with the civil rights campaign, who was a gay man. He's getting recognition not only from the Black community, but the queer community. And, it's just, yeah. And so it's like everyone around that movement, like the sphere is widening.
Yeah.
You know? And it's just, yeah, I feel like we would know more, because I wouldn't be surprised if we all like knew scenes from that movie, or we all knew footage from that movie, or even quotes, you know, if it's one movie on the historic March on Washington, which we all know footage from that. We know the I Have a Dream speech.
Right.
oh, I feel like she might be more of a household name, or we would at least recognize her work. Although we definitely recognize her work, because when you're talking about those glasses, I'm like, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yep.
Oh my God. Okay. I'm really excited for my eyesight to decline now. It's coming. It's coming.
It's interesting. Like, it's not that I don't like cat eye sunglasses, because I do. I really like them. I just don't like them on my face.
You have an influence of that, though, because the upper corners of your glasses are colored and more prominent.
I do it a little bit, but I don't do the full, like, really intense version.
Well, and, like, we're all subject to our times, and, you know, like, Harry Potter glasses have gotten really popular now that all the Harry Potter kids have come of age, you know, that kind of thing. The thick nerd glasses. We were all there. We all saw it happen. But again, that design is influencing your glasses because they're colorful and they have kind of like that point to them, that design, that flare.
Yeah.
But even the idea that glasses can be fashionable, she proved not only from an artistic standpoint, was it cool, but from a capitalistic standpoint, she proved it could be successful, that this was something that people wanted and would pay money for.
Yeah. Yes.
God damn.
It was amazing.
Oh, Tina.
I know. I still love that name. That's another name we can bring back.
Oh, my God. I know. Like, we don't need any more yada yada Lins that are spelled L-E-I-G-H-Y-Z-N. There are so many cool and unique names that we could really look to.
Right. And like, they're so unique that you don't need weird letters or numbers or like dashes in people's names.
I'm looking at you, Elon.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. You know what's super funny? My mom loved the name Caitlin. She thought it was such a pretty name. By the time she got pregnant with me, everyone was named Caitlin, and we all know like 20 Caitlins, and all their names are spelled differently. So she named me Emily, which also turned out to be one of the most popular names of the fucking 90s.
Right? I know.
She's like, Caitlin's been done. I'm going to name her Emily. And like every other mom was like, Caitlin's been done. I'm going to name my kid Emily.
That's super funny.
To be fair, I've never met a bad Emily.
Hey guys, we know times have been tough lately for all of us.
And during hard times, it can be difficult if you don't have anyone to talk to, or it can be hard to talk about certain topics.
Being alone with your thoughts can be isolating. This is why we are sponsored by BetterHelp.
BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who are trained to listen to and help you.
Talk to your therapist in a private online environment at your convenience.
BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. Thank goodness.
There's a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's 20,000 plus therapist network that gives you access to the help that may not be available in your area.
You just fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. That is Amazon fast. Then you schedule secure video and phone sessions. Plus, you can exchange unlimited messages, and everything you share is completely confidential, just like with an in-person therapist.
You can request a new therapist at any time at no additional charges. If you want to talk to someone about your mental health, you can get a 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/herstory. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/herstory. So, Emily. Who are you whining about?
I'm like, are you going to continue that sentence? I'm just going to sit here awkwardly.
No, we're just going to sit here awkwardly.
Oh, okay. Okay. No. Silence is great for an audio format. I love it. Just I love it.
Silence.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. It's time for silence again. I was hanging out with my dad, and I was like, hey, you know how you like came up with all those like witty and funny, he calls them his crinkled carols, but he takes Christmas songs and like, where he's like, I'll be home for Christmas. That depresses me. You know, he like,
yep.
And I'm like, well, I definitely took that from you because within like 20 minutes, I came up with a, you know, parody for the podcast introduction. And you could tell he was just like, that's my fucking girl. That's my fucking kid right there. Thank God he's never going to listen to this podcast. Okay, so today I am whining about Molly Williams.
Oh.
Do you know her?
No, actually.
Because that's the fucking point. Women that you should have heard of, but haven't.
Hell yeah. Even and us. Even yeah. We haven't heard of them.
Oh my God. I don't remember what it was. It was a weird series of thoughts. There was a gym in town that posted that there were some firefighters who did the step machine. And on September 11th, mm-hmm. they walked up the step machine the same number of floors as the World Trade Centers, and they were like in their gear, and it was kind of like a remembrance honoring thing. I'm like, oh my God, firefighters and like that history. It's so much. It's so fascinating. And I was like, I wonder where the women are and all that. So I Googled women firefighters history and found Molly. So here we are. And actually, they rearranged the equipment at my gym, so I run next to the step machine a lot. So nice. I was thinking about that while I was running, where I was like, "Huh, I should fucking Google that." I guess I've never really thought about it. Having a women's history podcast for 3-4 however many years it's been, I've never thought about it. So, when we imagine firefighters, we imagine men in heavy yellow jackets, lugging pounds of gear, including oxygen tanks, axes, and hard hats. What we may not imagine is a woman in a calico dress and checkered apron. But that is what the United States' first black firefighter and first woman firefighter, Molly Williams, wore while working with the Oceanus Engine Company number 11 in Lower Manhattan.
Manhattan.
Again, like, that's one of those words. If I didn't know how it was pronounced, I would be like, wait, I have to think about this. I would probably say Manhattan. Manhattan. Our story takes place in the early 1800s. Molly Williams was born into slavery, enslaved by Benjamin Amar, a New York City merchant. Amar owned a posh home at 42 Greenwich Street, where Molly spent her early years likely working in the home, caring for Amar's 8 fucking children. What a great time to be a man, where you just like pump it and forget about it. Pump and dump. Like, you don't have to worry about having 8 children because you have enslaved people to care for your children for you. Or a wife. It doesn't matter. So while New York was the first state to pass a law to fully abolish slavery in the United States, it was a slow and lackluster process. Enslaved children born after July 4th, 1799 in New York, would be freed upon turning 25 for women and 28 for men. Because, you know, we gotta keep the men around longer because hard labor and patriarchy and yada yada. However, if you had been born into slavery before July 4th, 1799, you were out of luck. This was your life. Sorry.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be until March 31st of 1817 that New York passed a law which initiated gradual emancipation, with full emancipation occurring on July 4th of 1827. They're really hung up on July 4th, and I get it in a symbolic way, but also, like, when people talk about the 4th of July and Independence Day, and they talk about, like, okay, but it wasn't independence for everyone, this is what they're talking about. Yeah. Because even at the time where states were passing laws for emancipation of enslaved people, they also acknowledged there was a certain irony in July 4th not being Independence Day for everyone. So it's hard to know where Molly fell in all this regarding her age and quote-unquote eligibility for emancipation, since we don't know her birth date. I did find one article that claimed that when our main story that I'll talk about takes place, she was 71. So this would put her far before the 1799 deadline.
Yeah.
Which means, like, she was enslaved for life, and sorry you weren't born later. Like, just...
horrible.
It's so horrible. It's so fucking horrible. And I think we talk about the human cost of slavery, obviously. But when we talk about the success of the United States as a country and like our economic prowess and this and that, we need to acknowledge that all of that is based on stolen labor and stolen people and stolen lives. Like, that's why they were doing this gradual thing, because they're like, well, we're going to really fuck up the economy if we just release all of these people who are giving us free labor. We need to give the businesses time to pivot.
Right.
Pivot. That's
bullshit.
And I'm like, I'm sorry. These are literal human beings' lives.
These are people. Yeah.
Anyway. So Amar also worked with the fledgling volunteer fire department of New York City. The city had already suffered several devastating fires. I mean, if you haven't had like a great fire, are you even a city? I don't think we had a great fire, but we had a tornado that really fucked us up.
Yeah.
And that's why we have St. Mary's and why the Sisters of Assisi went to the Mayos and were like, we need a hospital. And the Mayos were like, fucking raise the funds and we'll staff it. And then the Sisters were like,
bitch, please.
Challenge accepted. Yeah. We're here. We're done. Which, by the way, I was walking past the statue of, I can't remember her name. I want to say it was like Sister something. But she was like the head of the Franciscan Sisters. Yeah. Yep. And it's her and William Worrell Mayo. And it's like the statue of the two of them where she's like holding out her hand where she's like, it looks like she's like, give me money, but she's like, your turn.
Yeah, exactly.
In my head. So I saw that statue, but there was like a giant splattering of bird shit on William's forehead. And I'm like, this feels a certain kind of way.
Yeah.
And I'm loving it. I took a picture. I should post it to our Instagram, but I thought it was super funny. Anyway. So, the city had already suffered several devastating fires, and there were no dedicated firefighters. Rather, all able-bodied citizens were required to respond to fires and work to extinguish them. Which, like, I get, oh, you're able-bodied, just, like, go in and do what you're told. Like, I don't know how to fight a fucking fire. Dump water on it? Or sand? Where is the sand? Like, I wouldn't know how to fucking do that. And most lay people would not.
Right.
So New York's first proper fire department, the Volunteer Fire Department of the City of New York, was founded in 1737, consisting of 30 volunteers for New York City, which I know was not as big at the time, but still.
Yeah.
Holy crap. New York City So because New York City had already suffered several significant fires, prominent businessmen like Amar served as volunteers in order to protect their businesses. So like it was a lot of these like men's men, hard scrabble, like dur kind of guys. But then also wealthy businessmen would be volunteer firefighters because if their businesses caught on fire, game fucking over.
Yep.
You lost everything. And they wanted to be a part of protecting that. You know, they didn't want to put it in someone else's hands to make sure their building didn't burn down. So that didn't mean men like Amar were going to rough it at the firehouse, though. When reporting to the Oceanus Engine Company 11 firehouse in Lower Manhattan, Amar brought Molly to serve him and the other men because she had no choice because she was an enslaved person.
That's gross.
Along with domestic duties like cooking and cleaning, Molly also cleaned and maintained the hand-pulled water pumper. And the water pumper was probably one of the, if not the most important piece of equipment that the firehouse had. So at this time, there were no fire trucks, and even steam-powered water pumps had only begun being used in the early 1800s. And it was also still common for water pumps to be pulled with ropes by firefighters to the scenes of fires rather than by horses. Like the whole firefighting horse thing, it was a very short-lived burst in our history. But this was it was a giant tank full of water on a cart that people would hand drag to a fire using ropes.
Insane.
Can you fucking imagine? So because she spent so much time working in the firehouse, Molly learned the tools of the trade, including how to operate the water pumper. Again, this isn't steam powered. This is man powered. So people pull it and then people pump it. There is no easy way with this, except that there's a container to hold the water and they don't have to like create a chain of 10,000 people with buckets. So she earned a reputation among the men as being, quote, as good a fire laddie as many of the boys. Great. I'm sure that's all she ever wanted in her life. Except that she's an enslaved person who isn't volunteering like the other people are. I just want to make that very, very clear. Like, she's clearly a really cool person and she's doing good and important work, but we cannot ignore the fact that none of this is her choice. She is an enslaved person to a rich guy who's like bringing her along so he doesn't have to wash his own shorts.
Yep.
The winter of 1818 in New York was rough. A cholera outbreak had left many of the men bedridden, and Molly was tasked with caring for the sick men in the firehouse. Outside, a brutal blizzard ravaged the city.
Like the 1991 blizzard.
The 1991 Halloween blizzard. Okay. It was so crazy. In Minnesota, we will never shut the fuck up about the 1991 Halloween blizzard. Then the alarm went off. A fire was raging on William Street. There were only a few volunteers who were well enough to go. So in her calico dress and checkered apron, Molly joined the sparse crew as they ventured out into the frozen hellscape. She helped to pull the water pump through the snow, uphill both ways. When they arrived at the fire, she worked the pump to help extinguish the flames. And again, remember, this is all manual. Or ladual. Womanal. I'm not going to be one of those people that's like, try to take M-A-N out of every fucking word. Manual labor. So perhaps confused as to why a black woman was acting as a firefighter, onlookers asked Molly what engine she belonged to. And she said, quote, I belong to the old Levin. I allers run with that old bull engine. So she's like, yeah, this is the station that I belong to. This is who I go with. I'm a part of this.
Yeah.
As thanks for her bravery and work, Molly was made an unofficial member of the Oceanus 11.
Of course.
And they all referred to her as volunteer number 11. Remember, there was nothing voluntary about anything she did.
Right. I mean, I guess technically going to the fire was kind of voluntary.
But like,
but isn't the fact that she was even there wasn't.
Yes. And like, again, when a person is enslaved, even the choices that they make are influenced. You know, it's like you're under duress. The whole time, even a choice you allegedly like make for yourself
is not really a choice you're making for yourself.
Exactly. It's So I couldn't confirm this, but one article stated that Molly's husband opened a successful tobacco shop. Maybe it was fine tobacco. Maybe it was mid tobacco. Who knows? And was able to purchase his and her freedom, and their son became an abolitionist. There was like one website where I was able to find some more personal details, but I couldn't find anything to back it up. And I'm going to get into that. So much of Molly's story is, so I mean, hopefully she eventually was freed. Because I'm like, I'm sorry, she helped to put out this fire when everyone was sick with cholera, and you made her volunteer number 11 and an unofficial.
Yep.
Fuck off. Fuck right off. None of, like, honorary, it's cool. But does it mean anything practically? Is she no longer enslaved? No. It doesn't change her life. Oh, it's so frustrating. So so much of Molly's story is told as if it's legend, and many of the articles I found repeated the story word for word with a few added details if I was lucky, like literally copy-paste, that kind of jazz. So one of the earliest accounts of Molly comes from George William Sheldon in his book, The Story of the Volunteer Fire Department of the City of New York, and describes her as an old enslaved woman, quote, with her nice calico dress and checked apron, a clean bandana handkerchief nearly folded over her breast, and another wound around her head and rising up like a baby pyramid. So it's like he's describing her physical appearance. That's where we get the idea of the calico dress and the checkered apron. Who knows if that's even what she wore that day? I'm sure she didn't have a lot of wardrobe options in general. So this is the account where we get the only quote that I could find that's attributed to her about her belonging to the old leaven. So that's the only reason we have that quote. Who knows how valid it is. It should also be mentioned that the accounts of Molly paint her in this like Uncle Tom fashion where she's like grateful and happy in her position. And right. She's like just doing the work and she's happy to be working away for no pay with no bodily autonomy whatsoever. And that's because it's white men who are telling her story.
Yep.
And it feels more like an anecdote. It's like, oh my God, there was this fire and there was this black enslaved woman who was helping put it out. It was so crazy. And like she was, but then it's colored by that idea of like, oh, she was so happy to be doing her work. She was just like, it was virtue for her. That's why she did what she did. Not because she didn't have a choice. Unfortunately, we don't know much of Molly, her real story, or even her fate. I did find a blog that was like trying to figure out who she was and like find where she was buried or like connect her to some real people who were able to be found in the historic archives. And it kind of, the way it ended is like, I don't know. You know, they chased some leads and it didn't really, nothing conclusive came of it, which is unfortunate because it's not that person's fault. It's just that this is why we don't know a lot about Molly, because she was an enslaved black woman and no one's going to write down her story. No one's going to write down her history. The only reason we know about her is because she allegedly was a part of this fire rescue. And it was so odd that a black woman would be a part of the firefighters.
Yeah.
You know, and it also fed into that narrative of like, she just wants to help and, you know, she's a good worker and she's so happy for this opportunity, you know, just. So her story has been retold in the children's book, Molly by Golly, The Legend of Molly Williams, America's First Female Firefighter, by Diane. Oh, shit. I should have looked this up. Ockeltree, and illustrated by Kathleen Kemley. And I think that's really cool because it's giving that representation of women and specifically black women in traditionally masculine roles. And really what we have of this story is the legend. So why don't we use that legend for good?
Right.
And legend may be the best way to categorize Molly's story, but she gets our herstory seal of approval.
Oh, hell yeah.
I mean, so there, when you Google her, there are a bunch of photos of a black woman, like an official looking uniform, but because I couldn't find anything about her, like the veracity of her existence or the story, I think it's something to be said that the early accounts of her happened not too long after the story allegedly occurred, the fire. So I think the less distance between the retelling and the event, I think kind of closes the gap a bit, but I don't think the photo of this woman in like an official firefighter's like formal outfit is her. I don't know who it is. I couldn't figure it out.
Right.
Which is also unfortunate because I'm like, we have an actual photo of this person. Is it her? Is it like, but when I was looking up women firefighters, she is often credited, Molly Williams, as being the first woman firefighter, the first black firefighter, but I think we can acknowledge her as she's volunteer number 11, as tongue-in-cheek as that title is.
Yeah.
It was such a good story until I decided to figure out if it actually happened.
Yep.
I feel that
happens a lot.
There, when we first started this podcast, I think we were very much ready to retell the legends, regardless of historical.
Right.
But now, we've been doing this long enough. I think we're more apt to examine, like, okay, but what's the documentation? How do we know this happened? Right. You know, like let's look into the historical veracity of this event. And that's not going to stop us from telling the stories, because at the end of the day, we're telling stories. This is not a serious lecture on history.
Like, we try to get our facts right as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to spend 10 years researching one woman.
100%. I'm not going into archives.
Yep.
But yeah, I don't know. I thought it was cool. Molly Williams, Hursary headcanon, she defeated that fire and she found her emancipation. And yeah, slavery is bullshit.
Yep.
So Kelly, what are you thankful for?
That there is no slavery anymore. I mean, yeah.
Arguably.
True. Not in the way it used to be.
Yeah.
I am thankful that I had a family emergency last Friday, and I'm thankful that I was able to, like, super last minute take off work, drop off the dog somewhere, and be able to, like, go and be with my family with very, like, obviously the situation itself was stressful, but very minimal added stress.
No one was making you feel guilty about right. having to step away from your day-to-day life to address a family emergency.
Right. And I really appreciate that, both like my boss being super like chill about it, even though I was like, God, I feel so bad. I've missed, because we have a meeting on Fridays and I've missed like the last like three or four of them. And so I was like, really, I was looking forward to going. And so like when I called my boss to be like, I have this family emergency, like I'm probably not going to be there is what I said. And she's like, don't even think about it. She's like, not like going, but like, she's like, don't even like, whether you come or not, like, don't even put like, have that as a priority, because yeah. it's not family
let
is your
go.
Priority. And so I appreciate that. And I'll like, I appreciate, yeah, like having my mother-in-law be able to like take the dogs at the drop of a hat, or if she couldn't, knowing that you or another friend probably could have come and fed them at very least.
You could have dropped them off at my house. I don't fucking care.
Right. Like
my house is overrun with animals as is.
But just like knowing that we have those people that even if we luckily had the time to be able to drop them off somewhere, but if for some reason we hadn't, we would have had multiple people that probably could have either come and at least fed them, if not taken them
yeah.
for the weekend, or even just stayed here for the weekend. And I'm really appreciative of that, because it made it a lot easier. And, you know, like I was panicking enough about the family emergency. Like I didn't need to panic about everything else. So the fact that it was just really simple was really nice.
I think especially this has kind of come up since the pandemic, because people have had the opportunity to have more flexibility. More flexibility is being expected from employers, like between working from home and flexible hours and this and that. I think the joy and the, I'm trying to think of how to say this. I've been drinking entirely too much, but the privilege, not privilege, but just the right to yeah. have a life, to have an emergency, and to not have work impede your ability to address a family emergency. Like I know you and I came up during a time, you know, with the 2008 housing crisis and the recession and all that, where it's like, if you have a job, you suck someone's dick to keep it. Like
exactly.
You are so fragile. You are so disposable. And now employees have more of that power. And I think especially people in our generation and younger are prioritizing that work-life balance and treating employees like human beings.
Right.
I mean, like my boss has been really wonderful. If I've like, you know, had a family situation, or if I'm like, oh, hey, I'm going to help pick up my friend's daughter from,
right.
you know, stuff so she can have these other experiences. And it's like, yeah, totally go for it. You know, just keep your calendar updated. And I think that it's something that we shouldn't be like, oh, thank God. You know, it should be expected. Because when you're having a family emergency,
right.
the last thing you should be giving a shit about is work and what your boss thinks.
Right.
Now, if you're a surgeon who's scheduled to operate on someone, I get that. But like, for the most part, we should be able to step away from our jobs for an emergency without anyone making us feel bad about it.
Right.
I think we have all been made to feel so bad for having a personal situation that's interfered with work. And
yeah,
it's awful. It's so fucking awful.
I agree with you. And yeah, for me, it's kind of getting out of that mentality, because the jobs I had previously did make me feel bad.
I had to go to the ER for like a shitty retail job when I was in college. And my boss was
terrible.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And like the place I worked prior to working where I work now was the same way. Mm-hmm. And so like the fact that I don't need to be guilty about it is, you're right, we shouldn't. And yeah, it's so ingrained in me that now that I work at a place where I don't need to feel guilty, it feels weird.
You feel guilty for not feeling guilty? You're like, yeah. I have to feel guilty about this,
or
right?
Or I feel guilty, and then the person's like, why do you, what? Like, and I think
because
part of
I've
it
been
also
programmed
stems,
by capitalism.
Well, and I think it also stems from, like, I'm in a helping profession, and so it, luckily Fridays are pretty chill for me, mm-hmm. so I only had one client that I needed to cancel on, but, like, if it had been a Thursday, I'm like, I don't even know what I would have done. Like, yeah. And my boss was super chill because she was like, do you need me to cancel anyone for you? And I'm like, no, I have one client. Like, I can reach out to them. It's not a problem. So, like, even that offer of, like, hey, like, between, like, our administrative assistant and me, like, we can reach out to your clients if you need us to. Like, well, that was super appreciated, too. But even just, like, I think I have that, like, added stress of, like, not that any of my clients would blame me or be mad. Like, I mean, they might be a little frustrated because, you know, when your schedule changes last minute, there's always, like, a tiny bit of frustration.
Totally.
Not necessarily at the person, but at the situation.
100%.
And so, like, I don't think any of my clients would have even probably said anything except for maybe, like, expressing concern. But, like, I feel like I put extra pressure on myself because of that.
But how wonderful is it that you're working in a place that prioritizes not only your mental health, but your well-being as a person over the labor are providing?
Even, like, the next day, my boss, like, reached out to me and was like, hey, like, if you're busy with your family, like, you do not need to respond. But I just wanted to know, like, I'm thinking of you and I hope everything's good, really, aww, like, good. And, like, I, like, started tearing up, like, because, like, just, like, that genuine, because, like, bosses don't need, like, most bosses care about their employees, but, like, I still feel like that was above and beyond. And, like, well, it just felt very nice.
And reaching out in a way that is asserting that, you don't have to check in with me. I'm not checking in with you in a professional way.
I just want you to know I'm thinking of you
instead of being like, hey, checking in. When are you going to be back to work? Which that's awesome.
Yeah.
No. And I'm sorry for the situation you were in. I'm glad it turned out well. And I'm really glad that you have people in your life who are there to support you and that you have a job and a workplace that is going to support you in that kind of situation.
Because I even think about, like, Lydia with the dogs. There was no pressure of, like, are you coming to get them? It was like, hey, let me know when you're coming to get them. But there was no pressure of, like, you need to come get your goddamn dogs.
Well, even last Christmas when I was in Florida and I needed my dogs picked up from the kennel early, I called a bunch of people before I called you. I felt so bad about it. I'm like, Kelly's, like, one of your best friends. I think it's going to be okay, you know?
Yeah, and
like,
I hope I reassured you that it was, that I was just like, yeah, that's totally fine.
No. It doesn't matter what you do. I'm going to hate myself.
Yeah. And that's exactly, like, how I feel, because I feel like, even if, like, I have a coworker that's like, if you ever need a dog sitter, like, let me know. And I'm in my mind, I'm like, I will never let you know, because I feel like I'm imposing.
100%. Yeah.
Like, no, I don't care how much you want. Like, even Lydia, like, she asks us to bring over our dogs. And when we have to leave them there for more than, like, a few hours, I feel bad about it, even though she loves it.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm the same way. I'm the same way.
What are you thankful for?
Shit, I was hoping you forgot.
I, like, thought about it. I was like, did she say it? And I was like, no.
I was a second away from launching into the,
oh,
like,
I know.
Thank you so much.
I saw it in your face.
God damn.
She just really wants those tacos.
I really do. I also want to pee. Okay, yeah. So it's going to be kind of like a half and half. First of all, I'm really thankful for being able to spend time with my family over Thanksgiving, my partner's family, who's really wonderful. My parents' cat, Daniel, they found him when he was maybe about 10 years old.
Daniel.
He was living under their deck. He passed away.
What?
Yeah. Oh, shit, I didn't tell
is
you.
Is he not even, I swear he's not even that old.
He was like 10 when they found him,
oh,
and this is
9
years later. He was a little grandpa when they found him.
I forgot that he was that old when they found him.
Yeah, he had a really great life.
Yeah, he did.
It was definitely a, you know, they had to make the decision to ethically put him down because he was having seizures decision. And it wasn't great. It's been really hard on both of my parents because you know the old trope of like woman gets cat, man doesn't want cat,
man falls in love with cat,
man and cat become best friends. That was definitely my dad, and my dad loves cats. But my mom found Daniel when he was out of town and she called him and he's like, we can't keep the fucking cat. We have too many cats. And I remember I was living with you in college.
I remember.
And she called me and she's like, I don't know what to do about this cat because all the shelters were full. So
I remember
she was like
super stressing about
the cat. Yeah. And I was like, I was like, Mom, we both know you're keeping the fucking cat. If you need my validation, if you need my encouragement, my permission, you have it. But don't pretend you're not keeping this fucking cat.
Right.
He had a great life, but it was the day before my mom's birthday and he passed away.
No.
And my parents' first cat together died on my mom's birthday.
Oh my gosh.
We had another cat that also died around my mom's birthday. So like November's a really rough time for my parents and cats. I'm really thankful I got to spend Thanksgiving with them. My mom, you know, when we were going around the table saying we were thankful for, she like kind of choked up and was talking about like, I'm thankful for the time we had for Daniel. And like, I'm thankful for my fur babies. I complain about them constantly and they're all just the fucking worst and I love them and I wouldn't give them up for anything. But yeah, no, I'm thankful for the time that I've had with family and especially my fur babies. Babies, and even when Arthur scratches my face and is a total fucking asshole, I love him so much.
Yeah.
And I would kill for him, even if he didn't ask.
I know.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, just, it was a good Thanksgiving. It was a little emotional, but it was good. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Wine About History. We gotta fucking get off this, otherwise I'm gonna start crying.
Yeah.
Like us on Facebook at Whining About History, Instagram at WAHPAD.
Our website is whiningabouthistory.com, where you can find a link to all of our sweet ass merch, a link to our Buy Me a Coffee, where you can, for as little as $5 one time, buy us a bottle of wine that will either match to your name or whatever we're feeling like.
If you have a recommendation, like, we're so easy.
Unless it's over like $30, then we might not buy it.
I'm pretty desperate. I'm pretty desperate for love at all times. So maybe.
I said might not.
Might not.
Over 50 is probably a definitely not.
Oh my God. We'll
save
it.
Between 30 and 50, maybe.
That, become a patron too.
Yeah. And then, yeah, we also have a link to our patrons where you can donate for as little as $1 a month to get some extra content and some, what's it say?
Limited space remaining. Okay, yeah, so we should wrap recording. This up.
Yeah.
Okay. Raise 5 stars wherever you listen. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Whine About History because we're about to run out of memory on our memory card. Goddamn PS2 old video game shit. I'm Emily.
I'm Kelly.
Have an empowered day. Bye. Please tell me none of this got cut out because I swear to fucking swear God, to God, I'm gonna throw this across the room.
Right, hit
I'm gonna
the button. Pitch a fit. Hit the button.